The Guardian.
The Guardian has partnered with audible.co.uk to offer listeners a free audiobook when you sign up for a one-month, no-commitment trial of the Audible service. Audible has over 50,000 audiobook titles available to download. Go to guardian.co.uk/audible for further details.
Football Weekly Extra.
Well, that was a surprise then. Today, Champions League brings joy for fans of both Manchester clubs. United because City went out, City because United. In a stunning night of football in which Man United once again failed to beat the Basel owner and her team. We ask how, what, why and who. We salute Chelsea, Man City's next opponents, themselves safely through. And we say cheer up, as it could be worse. You could be Ajax, hustled out of Europe by a 7-1 Lyon win that's raised more eyebrows than the Ancelotti family. Elsewhere, we round up the news around Europe. There's a Juventus-Roma classic to look forward to, the big Tevez to Milan transfer saga, Sid Lowe on the Classico, tweets, posts, and our roundup of the weekend's Premier League action in today's Football Weekly Extra. The atmosphere electric here in the pod, listeners, as we prepare to break down one of the most surprising nights of football in a long, long time. Standing by, Amy Lawrence. Hi, Amy.
Hello.
Philippe Auclair. Bonjour.
Bonjour.
And hi, Rob Smythe.
Hi.
Going to be interesting to hear what you have to say about the events on Wednesday night. For the first time ever in the Premier League, only two English teams going through. The City and United results, of course, everybody knows. But they were the big surprises. Let's begin with United. Rob.
Yeah, it's obviously a huge surprise in the context of a team that got to three finals in 4 years. But if you watch them since the middle of September, it's not really a surprise. They've been sleepwalking to 1-0 victories. And they played no better or no worse last night, really. They've been a thoroughly mediocre side since the middle of September. And you know, Barl aren't a great side, but they're handy enough. And I wasn't hugely shocked. I was really surprised by the general complacency in England that United needed a draw and would get a draw. It was never quite that straightforward.
But a group with Otterlo, Benfica and Basel, they only needed to avoid defeat in Basel, and they lost in Basel.
It's a humiliation without question, because it's only the third time under Ferguson. One of those was in 94 when the groups were still tough and English teams were still learning, so that you can write that off. But they just haven't been playing well for a long time now. It's 3 months they haven't put a performance in, really.
What's a bigger humiliation, this or the 6-1 against City?
In terms of actual humiliation, I think the 6-1.
Yeah.
This is obviously more damaging because 6-1 ultimately means 3 points, but this means Channel 5 and Thursday night.
Mm. All right. Let's give... are we going with Barl or Basel? I was going with Basel myself.
Absolutely Basel.
Basel. Basel. Should we give Basel some love?
That's
what I call Strella Dam, eh?
Yeah. Oh.
No, I think.
Enter Shakir.
I mean, I think you're being slightly harsh on Basel being so sort of. It's a given that United should have gone there and got their draw. They're a decent side, and I think it's ridiculous to oversimplify it and say that the playing fields have been levelled out in Europe. But definitely since
their
Platini
playing field wasn't
has,
anything like level, of course. But, yeah.
Since Platini has made great efforts really to encourage, if you like, the smaller nations and the smaller countries to go further. Even Trabzonspor nearly qualified last night, but for Inter Milan being absolutely, well, I struggled to find the right adjective, really.
Inter.
Perfect, thank you. Yeah. Thank you. You know, that would have been Trabzonspor through, and they really shouldn't have even been in the competition but for what's going on in Turkish football. But Basel are a decent side, and in Strella and Alexander Frey, they've got players who probably should have done better in Europe when they went and played outside of Switzerland.
I'm miming a goalkeeper, Sommer. Wasn't he great?
Yeah, he's
he catches the ball. I love
that. Catch the ball, and he gave a nice interview afterwards. He seems like you could imagine that there were people in big European clubs watching him and sort of the way he conducted himself off the pitch as well as on, thinking he'd be one you wouldn't mind having in a very big club sometime soon.
Did he catch your eye, Amy? Is that the subtext here?
That's not what I'm saying, but I would also say, just stat fans, thanks James, that he played against, I think it was in the same tournament where Joe Hart was in the final of the Switzerland under 19s maybe. They were two clearly, you know, very good young keepers with a future, and they're both developing extremely well, and I think Sommer will be one of a few of that Basel team that they'll struggle to keep hold of.
And one thing that should be stressed for Basel is the fact that they've done what they've done after losing the manager whom everybody thought was the main person responsible for getting there in the first place, Thorsten Fink, who has been replaced by Mr. Vogel, his former assistant with Ingolstadt and Basel. And obviously it hasn't affected the group at all.
No.
And anyway, Manchester United, I mean, the problem was not really yesterday. The problem was what happened at Old Trafford when they were 2-0 up, and they simply didn't give Basel the respect they deserved, and they were punished for that.
And yet there was a peculiar kind of complacency last night in that everyone was saying we were complacent against Basel in the first game, but it's okay now, we won't be, which in itself is a form of complacency. Just to go back to Basel, two things. Shaqiri looks a fascinating player for a 19-year-old. And English football has been taught lessons on the field in the last month in Europe, but also off the field. Napoli's fans, Basel's fans contrast with the atmospheres, particularly at United and City, but also I know Dortmund were quite scathing about Arsenal. So there's a lesson there, you know. I mean, the complete contrast.
What about financially? David Conn commenting yesterday, looks like Man United now paying the price of the £600 million taken out by their owners since 2005. Of course, this exit could cost another bucket load of millions. You've got some interesting numbers relating to their actual spending.
Yeah, there are a lot of people who are still in denial about how much money the Glazers have taken from the club, but the numbers are quite damning. Since Ronaldo left, United's net spend is minus £6 million. Now, that's lower than Hull, Burnley, West Brom,
minus
Leeds.
£6 million.
Yeah, it's only over 3 years, but even so, Burnley, even Blackpool have spent more than United in that time. So that's a lot. If you go back to 05, United are eighth in terms of net spend below when the Glazers took over, below Sunderland, Stoke, Villa, as well as Spurs, Liverpool, Chelsea and United. Since 2005, United's net spend is £58 million. Chelsea's is 245, City's is 426. Lord knows what Real Madrid's is. Ferguson's a genius who's kept them there for a while and probably will continue to do so with an average squad, but he can't do it forever.
Is it an average squad? Is it really?
I totally see what you're saying, but if you just want to go back a few weeks to when United beat Arsenal 8-2, for example, this kind of conversation would have been impossible to imagine. And certainly at the beginning of the season, it looked like they had a young squad, were integrating, you know, new players that they'd identified and brought in at the right time, and it looked like everything was set up for them to continue to do what they've been doing for these last years. So it's peculiar from that perspective to see how things have changed.
I would also say that the sale of Cristiano Ronaldo anyway skews up all the figures,
but it's still £80 million they don't have to spend.
Well,
it does skew the figures, but
they have actually
spent
rather a lot of money, Manchester United, I mean, over the past few years.
I
seem to remember they bought somebody called Phil Jones for
yeah, but
an awful
but their
lot
net
of
spend,
money.
Their Rob's point is they also finance that by selling off their best player.
Yeah, but their net spend is negative over
but
3 years.
I'm dreaming here. Why is it a bad thing? Bayern Munich also, you know, Arsenal... the fact that Real Madrid and Barcelona, because of the way they're financed by, you know, Caixa Catalunya and all those banks, and they can afford to do all these sort of things and spend so much money. What's so great? I think that it is to be applauded what Ferguson has done, honestly. There are other reasons. They haven't been exactly spared by injuries. They've had some injuries to key players at key times. They're really missing Tom Cleverley, who is a real find and who was really the impetus at the beginning of the season. They're missing a player who can fill that role.
But surely it's an indictment that they're dependent, as dependent as they are on Cleverley, a player who's played 7 games for the club. That's not good. You say about injuries, and Ferguson will use that as an excuse. Last night they were missing 3 players from their best 11, Hernandez, Cleverley and Carrick, who was suspended.
And Vidic for significant
amount. Yeah, okay, and Vidic would have cleared the second goal, I accept that. But I'm not saying spending money is good. That's a different argument entirely. I'm saying the money isn't there because the Glazers are stripping it at a rate of however many million a year. Are you telling me Ferguson really believes in a... See, Wenger has a project, he has a vision and kind of idealistic, and it's... very admirable. Do you really think Ferguson has it? I don't.
Yes, I do. I'm absolutely convinced of it. I think
Ferguson almost quit because they wouldn't give him money in the 90s. He threatened to quit.
He's also the first...
He's broken the British transfer record
the first
times.
Thing that Alex Ferguson did when he arrived at Manchester United in November 1986 was to go to the academy, to bring the academy players within the first team, make them train with the first team. And the first thing he commented upon is that the youth policy in that club has gone completely down the drain, and he rebuilt it from scratch. And what he's doing now, he's doing what clubs should be doing, I believe, is that we have financial fair play coming into it. We are crossing our fingers it's going to happen. The clubs, which actually deserve to be called great clubs, are trying to clean up their act. And the fact that Glazers are here is neither that they're taking money away. Yes, they're taking money away. On the other hand, Manchester United, the problem is not is the debt. The problem is not the way the club is run. The club, I think you'll agree with me, is run very, very well indeed.
In what sense?
In the sense that it is...
Three finals out of 4 years, second in the Premier League?
$600 million in debt.
That's exactly. The debt is it's a different matter. I think if you put the Glazers on and the debt on one side and say, yeah, OK, they're taking money, the ownership model is not what you would wish. Mm. But if you look at the club itself, you look at the team, you look at the actual management, including the financial management, the results are very, very good. It is a club which is run by professionals. The fact that the Glazers are here, well, is for me a different matter altogether. And to link the exit of the Champions League to the Glazers being at the club, for me, doesn't make any sense at
all. Well, how can they not be connected, though?
How can it not make sense when they're negative?
It's not the owners who are on the pitch. It's not the owners who are picking the team.
No, it's a load of poor players because they don't have money.
They're not poor players. They're not poor players.
That team is mediocre.
There are problems. There is a big problem is the fact that De Gea, Lindegaard situation still hasn't been sorted. We thought it would have been by now. A lot of money was spent on a very young and very promising young keeper who has been at fault on a number of occasions, was again yesterday night. The fact that Lindegaard has been preferred for some important games, I don't know what kind of message that sent, but this hasn't been sorted.
Since the 95 crop, the Beckham crop, basically nobody has come through apart from O'Shea and Wes Brown. People say that Ferguson is committed to you, Fletcher, okay. But he's let people like Rossi go, Piqué go. How committed is he? You've got Paul Pogba, one of the most promising young playmakers in Europe, who is apparently about to leave because he can only get on the Carling Cup on the bench when Darren Gibson gets a game.
If Paul Pogba were to leave Manchester United, it would have nothing to do with the opportunities he's been given. It would have to do with proposals made by other clubs, particularly Italian clubs, who have noticed that Paul Pogba was available, as he hasn't signed a contract yet. On January, he will be available at a fraction of the price he's worth on any market.
And how ironic.
Yeah, well, there you go.
Well, it is a contentious issue and one which is set to run and run. Injury is certainly increasingly a factor, and reserves having to step up to take the place of not only Hernandez now, but also Nemanja Vidic, which could be absolutely crucial. How long is he likely to be out for?
Well, medial ligament, so it could be... The medial ligament was the minimum damage. They didn't know any more the last time we heard, so theoretically he could be out for the whole season.
Wow, OK.
That's an enormous play.
Wolves this weekend...
He's the best defender by
who actually beat them at Molineux last season.
Yeah.
Are things going to take an even worse...
Is it at Old Trafford?
This is at Old Trafford, though.
I'm sure you'd like to win 1-0.
Now, Manchester United's neighbours also going out. Tempted to say there's not as much to read into this. Firstly, because they actually won their game. And all right, they made mistakes beforehand. But it's also true that in six of the seven other Champions League groups, their points total would have been enough to see them through. So should we say, is this just bad news for their title rivals?
Probably, yes. I mean, I think they were right to feel a bit hard done by...
Hard done by no, Amy.
Well, only in the sense that, as you say, you know, Mancini was perfectly entitled to look at the other groups and think 10 points would have would have put them through.
Yeah.
In fact, half the time, the runner-up in the other groups had less than 10 points. So, but City, again, we've just talked a lot about Man United, but I think there is a massive difference that City can look at. When their group came out, everybody acknowledged that it was the group of death. When United's group came out, everybody thought, oh my goodness, here we go again. And United were entitled to rub their hands together gleefully and think, well, hey, you know, luck's in. So it's clearly feels like a much more damaging blow for United to have not been able to take care of what looked like a gift of a group. Where, again, when we're talking about the English clubs, it's obvious we're going to focus on them. But in the same way that you analyse what United did wrong instead of praise Basel, if you spend too long trying to analyse what Man City went wrong, we really need to be praising Napoli as well.
Well, indeed.
Had a phenomenal campaign.
I'd like to praise Jamie Redknapp as well, who repeatedly stressed in the Champions League coverage on Sky. Napoli were also first-timers in this competition. We didn't see them fuffing around and dropping silly points all over the shop. Napoli, indeed, had won none of their previous nine games away from home in European competition. And it was a bit of a nervous match, that, at Villarreal. For a long time, wasn't their best performance by a long stretch in Europe, but eventually they got the goals, a cracking strike from Inla, and then bundled over the line by Hamsik, and through they go. And the biggest night of celebrations for Neapolitan fans since, well, 2007, really, when they returned from the depths of despair and debt and all that kind of thing. So absolutely terrific to see them through. I know people are saying, oh, it's a shame we weren't going to see David Silva and that, but it's terrific that we are going to see Napoli and their brave and brazen style of counter-attacking football. Sorry, Rob.
Sorry, no, I was going to say, you'll probably know more about this than me. The one thing that concerned me as a City fan is Mancini's overall record in the European Cup. Now, was there a sense of interest or why? Because Inter kept winning the league by, what, 20 points going out in the last 16.
It's so curious, isn't it? And indeed, somebody said to Mancini in the post-game interview yesterday, this is your first time in the Champions League. And he didn't correct them, and I can imagine he didn't want to bring it up because he does have a disastrous record. I don't know what the problem is. I genuinely don't. There is this issue when you talk about City, the fact that they're dominating the Premier League one, they're doing it in Europe. People say different rhythms, different tactics, etc. Well, Mancini knows those rhythms. He knows those tactics. He played in Italy. He managed in Italy enormously successfully, except when he tried to do it in Europe. I don't know what it is about the mentality of must-win cup games. But he had some spectacular disasters with Inter.
And with Lazio
as well, yeah. But did he with Lazio? Specifically with Inter, I remember in the Champions League, must-win games in Valencia, where the team just failed to turn up, just clearly weren't on the ball. And yet his team plays so well in the Premier League.
I wouldn't say that they've played badly in the Champions League. They've actually had their moments. I mean, I remember the first game against Bayern, the first 20 minutes, they were absolutely magnificent. Mm. The home game against Napoli, which was a cracking game of football, they also played very well. And I say, I wouldn't say hard done by, but there's an awful lot of teams which have qualified for the round of 16, which are far, far, far inferior to Manchester City. The thing which is very important when it comes in, setting aside Mancini for a second, teams, including big teams, take time to get used to Europe. It took Alex Ferguson quite a while to gel the all-conquering Premiership team, you know, from 92, 93 and onwards into something which resembled success in Europe. Similarly, Arsenal took a very long time to have an impact on the European competitions, despite the fact that they were, you know, exchanging titles with Manchester United. And when you look at the list of players, and you check out the number of Champions League games they had played prior to this season. Mm. Almost nothing.
Really?
Almost nothing. Most of these players, they might have played a bit of... Yaya Touré has played. I was going to say there are some exceptions, okay, but you can go through the whole team. Gael Clichy is probably the most experienced, I would imagine, because he's played a lot with Arsenal of Champions League games. But a number of them haven't. It's a new territory for them.
All right. Well, they've got the perfect game to bounce back because Monday night sees them at Stamford Bridge taking on Chelsea. If they win that, laying down a big marker all over that Premier League title race thing. But this Chelsea team that they're facing, who was at Stamford Bridge the other night? It was you, Philippe, wasn't it?
Yes, I was, yes.
This Chelsea team that they're facing is fresh from two straight 3-0 wins, and Andre Villas-Boas has done a bit of a clean out. He sent one or two players to the naughty step, and told the reporters what he thinks of them as well. Yeah. Is it a new era?
I don't know.
Oh.
I think the jury is still very much out in the case of Andre Villas-Boas.
Mm-hmm.
It was a very brave move what he did against... it was brave and it was not brave, in funny. I'm contradicting myself here.
No,
what was brave was the fact
it's enigmatic.
He is enigmatic, I must say. What was brave is the fact that he's trying to introduce players like Romeu, for example, who's making a real impression in that team. I mean, he really looks the part, doesn't he? Leaving Frank Lampard on the bench. All these kind of decisions. But on the other hand, you could say that was one big step forward. On the other hand, this was a big step backward, literally so, because the team played basically in their own 30 yards, a la Inter de Mourinho. And funnily enough, they play like this, and suddenly we see the great Drogba again. And Drogba was absolutely extraordinary. I mean, he was honestly magnificent. But it was because he was playing in a system that looked very much like what it was with José Mourinho, sometimes Carlo Ancelotti. So when he was asked about that, and he was actually saying that his philosophy, the thing that never dies within the club, had more to do with human values than with tactical systems.
Oh, that's nice.
That's the way he presented it.
Okay. I was going to ask if he'd spoken about it. I wonder to what extent it was pre-planned and to what extent it was just because they scored
completely
so early.
Completely pre-planned.
Oh, really?
It had been worked out. He confirmed that they had actually prepared for that game specifically.
And they looked so much better and so much more comfortable.
Now, if they were to beat Man City on Monday night at Stamford Bridge, where they've lost, what, three of the last five games, I think? But if they were to win that game, my word, what an extraordinary title race it would make. Having said that, the prospect of David Luiz going up against Sergio Aguero et al. Is quite a quite an appetising one.
Well, I think, again, when you reflect on Chelsea's performance in midweek, what luck for them to come up against a Valencia team who played as if they were already, you know, completely hopeless. There really wasn't a great opposition, and I think that made quite a difference on the game and made it really easy for Chelsea to look comfortable.
What do you reckon on the City's chances at Chelsea then?
I think City have got a very good chance at Chelsea. I think City remain the most in-form and balanced team in the Premier League at the moment, with the most sources of goals. And I think Chelsea, although obviously they're going to feel a whole lot better about themselves after the last couple of results. Incidentally, I think the first time they won consecutive games for about almost 2 months. So that just shows how unstable they have been. We have to see whether they've really got their rhythm back or whether they're still a bit susceptible, and City will be a great test of that.
The thing with Chelsea, they actually have played very well in fits and bursts. In almost every game I've seen of them, and I think I've seen all the home games this season, they always showed something at some point. Juan Mata is absolutely magnificent. And at times when it was clicking, you thought, I can see what he's trying to do. But it's very much a work in progress. And what is it? Generally, you have time in pre-season to do all this. Mm-hmm. It seems like he's experimenting as he's going along, which is why everybody's a little bit unsure about the way it's going to go.
Mm. In the old days, when they had pre-seasons, you could have sorted this out. Nowadays, they fly off to some far-flung place. Yes. Now, elsewhere, Arsenal already through. And thank goodness, Amy, because I can understand your admiration for the Basel goalkeeper, given what your reserves, Almunia and that fellow Vita Minoni, got up to on Tuesday. Extraordinary, no?
I think if Arsenal learned one thing from their trip to Olympiakos, it was that they've got to pray to the heavens that nothing happens to Wojciech Szczesny.
Right. And they've got Everton at the weekend. Any thoughts on that? Straightforward?
I think they'd be hoping for a straightforward win. And obviously the team will be a lot stronger, although they've got to figure out what to do at left-back, because I don't think there's a single full full-back at all anymore.
Mm. Yeah.
I don't think it's going to be as straightforward as that. The other thing is that it's going to be one of those games which is going to be surrounded with the ceremonies for the 125th anniversary of the creation of Arsenal. And often when you do have these kind of commemorations in a club, it does have an adverse effect. It's strange, on the crowd in particular, because everything will be about celebrating the 125 years of history, rightly so. And sometimes it can have, I don't know, it can. I remember what happened, you know, in the Man City game, which of course was to commemorate a tragedy.
Hmm.
But certainly the players, it got to the players
right.
quite a bit.
Producer Ben is worried about the consequences for Arsenal if the crowd was to go quiet. at the Emirates.
The Emirates is not as quiet as people say it is, actually.
Ars Technica says, midweek results make me appreciate Wenger just that much more. Interesting point. I'm going to sail past that, though, to the other big story from those midweek Champions League games. It happened in the Real Madrid, Ajax, Lyon, Dinamo Zagreb group. Ajax, you'll have seen the story, basically looked set to go through. They were way ahead of Lyon on goal difference. They had... they had 3 points more of them in the group. But then all sorts of strange things happened. Basically, Ajax, half-time, were losing 2-0 to Real Madrid after having two perfectly good goals ruled out. But Lyon, meanwhile, who were losing 1-0 to Dynamo Zagreb and had only scored 2 goals in the previous 5 Champions League matches, somehow came back after the break and scored the 7 goals that they exactly needed to go through in Ajax's place. Plenty of people saying, ooh, that's a curiosity. There's all sorts of differing views here. I don't know which one is right. People posting in from Zagreb saying, listen, the strange thing would have been if Dinamo hadn't conceded 6 goals. They're that bad. And basically this is the last game before the winter break and the players just wanted to be out of there. But plenty of other people posting out that corruption does exist in football, whether for betting reasons or because of collusion between teams. It's documented. And when you look at a result like this, and especially the way Dinamo defended in that second half, it is legitimate to raise the question. Indeed, Philippe, I believe I'm right in saying that the French betting authorities have launched an investigation into this game.
Yes, there's an organisation called ARGEL, which is the Autorité de Régulation des Jeux en Ligne, which is basically the watchdog for online betting,
mm-hmm.
Have opened an inquiry, the result of which should be known actually later on today.
Oh, that's quick.
It's very quick because, contrary to what is being tweeted all over the place, absolutely no irregularities have been detected so far,
right.
First thing. So the inquiry is to determine whether there have been suspicious money flows online, basically, around that game. That is what the inquiry is about. And it's not because they have already identified irregularities that they actually have opened an inquiry. There's a very big difference. And what I find extraordinary, but absolutely typical, is that people are already jumping to the conclusion that not the two games were fixed. Because, let's face it, guys, not only would have Lyon have to pay off Dinamo Zagreb, but they would also have to pay off Ajax, the referee of the Ajax game. This would be, I mean, quite an operation. I can tell you that.
It's true. I just couldn't help but think of Jonathan Wilson's story about that Romanian championship a while back when watching it for entirely coincidental reasons. So anyway,
I can tell you that you are very, very upset about the accusations, some of which actually have come from people who should know a little bit better. I'm thinking of Mr. De Boer, who is talking about a striking result.
Frank De Boer.
Frank De Boer. I don't think that goes down very well. Doesn't reflect very well on Ajax, I must say, or Mr. De Boer.
Well, he would probably raise the question whether it reflects well.
Well, maybe he should raise the question why his team lost 3-0 at home, hey?
Well, he should raise that with the referees who disallowed two goals.
Well, I mean, I don't buy that for a second. It really annoys me. It really, really annoys me. And I can understand that Bernard Lacombe and people at Lyon are absolutely furious about this. These kind of accusations are very, very serious. Actually, they can't be more serious than that.
No, I appreciate that.
They should be kept out until if this evening, indeed, irregularities, I'll get there, have been spotted, then we can start and talk about it and speculate. At the moment, I find it completely irresponsible.
But doesn't the question have to be raised for somebody to investigate the irregularities? And
not necessarily. It's
not necessarily a betting thing. It might be a collusion.
The people from the regulation authority actually were very clear. They actually talked to some of my French colleagues and said, this type of inquiry, I wouldn't say it's routine, but it's something which is done quite regularly. And most of the time, people are not even aware of the fact this inquiry is taking place.
Right. Okay, no, absolutely. And if there's nothing wrong, but I don't think there's anything wrong with raising the question when there is a suspicion given.
Surely if the board wants to raise a question, you should do so privately. That's fine, but there's no reason for him to come out publicly and start rambling about weird results.
Right. But anyway, let's move on, eh? What about Lyon and Marseille? Can they do anything in the Champions League briefly this year?
Lyon, you mean?
And
Lyon.
Marseille?
Marseille, we are in shock.
Right.
Because I remember I was in Paris this weekend and we had a long conversation, you know, about the next France football issue and, you know, trying to think, well, which games are we going to prioritise? And everybody thought, if there's one team that's going to go through, it's got to be Lille. Because, you know, they had done the most difficult thing, winning away in Moscow. They had Trabzonspor at home. Wow, they should go through, you know, they had to win. They didn't. 0-0. They're out. And then on the other hand, Marseille does the incredible, winning at Dortmund. Actually, nobody's talked about fixing for this game as well. I mean, just, you know, while we're at it, why not?
Oh, did you see that goal by Valbuena? Come on, that could hardly be
absolutely
fixed.
Absolutely superb.
It was the ball. It's these new balls.
Robot control.
Nobody expected Lyon, of course. Marseille was a bit of a surprise as well.
Is it all because of Monsieur Platini, for Mika Atomica, saying, let's give Lorient some credit? 10 different nations represented. And we've talked about some of the teams in the knockout stages at Apoel, seeded, although I think the technical term is pipped in their case. But, I mean, just if you wanted anything that's emblematic of the new order sweeping the Champions League, is it that? Was it Harry Redknapp saying other managers will be jealous because I'm out of Europe and the rest?
I think it's too early to say that. I hope that that is going to happen over time. But, I mean, for example, City's knockout next year, City will presumably be going to have a stronger ranking and therefore going to an easier group. You'd expect them to go through. We agree that United should have gone through, or ordinarily would have gone through anyway. So, therefore, it's not. I think it's too early to say Platini's changes are working.
All right, then. Very briefly, Philippe, Rafa Benitez, is he going to Paris Saint-Germain?
No.
Oh. Okay.
No, I mean, that's another crazy rumour. I mean, it's extraordinary. Our job these days seems to be about saying this is not going to happen.
Where did this crazy rumour come from then?
Well, I know quite
it
precisely
wasn't
where it comes from.
The Qatari owners of Canal Plus releasing the information.
Well, the problem is that Leonardo, who, by the way, hasn't covered himself in glory since he's arrived in Paris Saint-Germain, I must say, and is the way he's behaved towards Antoine Kumbuari, one of the legends of that club, is nothing. It's shocking, disgraceful. There you go. I'm very angry about that. Because Antoine Kumbuari is probably one of the most respected figures in French football. What he did with Valenciennes, what he was trying to do with PSG, is a guy who represents the history of PSG, the short history but very beautiful history of PSG in the 90s, a famous victory against Real Madrid when he scores the winner and so forth. To treat him like that is just appalling. And he's been basically looking after a suitable replacement for Mr. Kumbuare since the summer. He approached Carlo Ancelotti, we know that. Ancelotti, to his great credit, said, I don't want to get involved into that. So we had to say, no, it's not going to happen. Then, I mean, basically, they're running out of options. At the moment, they're putting huge pressure on Claude Makélélé to be an interim manager for PSG. Makélélé doesn't want to hear about it because he's a very close friend of Kumbuare. He doesn't want to do this sort of thing, but he might be put in a situation where he has no choice.
Mm.
And Benitez, Leonardo and Ancelotti, there is a relationship here, even if an Italian friend of mine said Leonardo is more Ancelotti's friend than Ancelotti is Leonardo's friend. And whereas the relationship between Leonardo and Benitez must be a slightly different dynamic, mustn't it?
It all adds up to one thing.
Which is?
Certain Swede, Cuban heels. All right, then. Look forward to that.
Well, we could start the rumour.
Yep. Consider it done.
Should we start it now?
All right, you tweet that while I move
on. I can tell you within 2 hours it's going to be the great story.
All right, excellent. Good.
That's the way it works, isn't it?
It might happen. We could get a cup. Fantastic. Just wanted to mention as we move on from the Champions League that big game coming up in Italy this weekend, Roma against Juventus. No love lost between those two. Roma in all sorts of trouble coming into this. The fans have begun to call for the manager's dismissal. Nothing new there, perhaps. They had three players sent off in their 3-0 defeat last weekend. They're going to be without Gago, Juan, and Bojan. And they're taking on the team that is steamrolling through Serie A at the moment, Juventus. And I don't know. I mean, this is a spirited game. It's at the Stadio Olimpico, but oof, Juventus. Anyway, well worth catching that one. The big story, of course, currently dominating the front pages of the Gazzetta, apart from Napoli going through to the knockout stages of the Champions League, is, of course, the Carlos Tevez to Milan thing, where Milan announced, we've got a deal with Tevez, and now we're going to talk to his club, because they have got a deal, which, if the figures are true, involves him taking a more than 50% pay cut on his Man City deal.
Takes him down to, what, 125,000 a week?
80, I think.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it's quite significant, but that might be after tax, because that's how the Italians do things. But apparently, yeah, their deal with him is that we're going to buy him after the end of the season, but we'll take him on loan for the present. I don't know why they want to have a trial period, but there you go.
The salary,
yep,
is actually the exact equivalent.
Oh.
Ben, it's the exact equivalent because it's net of tax.
Oh, okay.
Since it would be 50% in England, they divided his wages by two, so to speak. But the gross wages are divided by two. But at the end of the season, it will still be 5 million euros net.
All right, so there'll still be bread on the Tevez table. That's important.
Yeah.
What kind of transfer fee do we think Tevez might be available
for? I mean, it's very much a buyer's market for him, isn't it? Because Mancini's still saying, no, we want to sell, we don't want a loan. But ultimately, more than anything, they just want to get him out of the...
I wonder how easy it's going to be to get a figure, because, you know, Milan will obviously feel they're in a great position to offer not very much.
And they're specialists in doing this. I mean, Pato posting in saying, I don't like this deal because I don't like Tevez as a person, but it is, and if it goes through, it'll be another coup for Milan. And Galliani, who's picked up Ibrahimovic cheap, Robinho in much the same way, Cassano after he fell out with Sampdoria, Kevin Prince-Boateng in a bizarre deal which saw him loaned out by Genoa, Aquilani on loan, Nocerino. I mean, the list goes on, but they've done some extraordinary deals.
But by the same token, it's reflective of the kind of deals that Man City are having to do.
Yeah.
I mean, when you look at Adebayor at Tottenham, for example, it's an amazing piece of business for Spurs.
Part three begins in classic fashion with Sid Lowe on the line from what I can only surmise is Madrid. Hi, Sid.
Hello, James.
Let's talk about Madrid for a second. 6 wins out of 6. Huge numbers of goals scored. Very, very, very few goals conceded. Throw some crazy stats at us.
Well, I'll throw some crazy stats at you. 15 victories in a row in their last 15 competitive games for Real Madrid. Aggregate score across those 15 victories, 57-9. They lead Barcelona by 3 points at the top of the Spanish table, with a game in hand, of course, because Barcelona are going to the World Club Championships, which all sets it up very nicely for the Clásico, because they could be 9 points clear of Barcelona. And as I think I've said to you before, that would mean, frankly, that the league title was very, very close to being all over.
All right, then. And how crazy is the build-up as we approach the big day?
Well, it's pretty excited. I think it's excited because everybody sees this as a Clásico that's far closer than it's been over the last few years, and that this is. This is very, very big, I think, not just for Barcelona, because there's a sense of, you know, kind of not the end of an era. That would be far too overblown to say that. But this is an opportunity now for Real Madrid, perhaps, to climb ahead of them. But also for Real Madrid, because all of these victories would feel a little bit hollow if Real Madrid then don't beat Barcelona, or at least don't maintain their lead at the top of the table over Barcelona. But I must admit, I think Real Madrid in such a strong position that a draw would be a good result for them. It would maintain a six-point lead at the top of the table, which I still think is really, really big in a league which neither team drops many points. Last year, for example, before winning the league, obviously on the league it's different, before winning the league, Barcelona had only dropped 14 points all season. That tells you about the kind of importance of only 6 points. So I think Real Madrid, if they think about it cautiously, and you know, all right, so beating Barcelona would knock them out of it perhaps completely, but even a draw for them would say, right, 6 points, let's carry on like this.
Sid, hello. Madrid have been bashing teams, as you said, playing great football, but we know how Mourinho likes to play against Barcelona. What do you think his tactics will be?
What do you mean by that, Rob?
You know, parking the bus and all that.
I thought you meant getting rough.
Oh, sorry. Oh, well, I meant more just defensively, Ronaldo up front on his own and so on.
All right.
Yeah, I think, well, there's one significant change, I think, from the way that Madrid have been playing for a reasonable chunk of this season. They've largely been playing 4-2-3-1 with a creative line of three behind the striker. I think it'll be 4-3-3, and so he'll try and reinforce the middle of the pitch. It'll be Xavi Alonso with Lassana Diarra and Sami Khedira. So perhaps a bit more defensive. But I think the kind of desire of Mourinho's detractors in Spain to jump on him and accuse him of defensive, obviously is destroyed to some extent by the statistics of all of these other games. Also, I think it's a slight red herring, and I think deep down Real Madrid fans couldn't care less. If they go and beat Barcelona 1-0 and it's a fluky goal, say from a ropey penalty or something like that after a defensive performance, they'll be reasonably happy with that. Now, of course, they'd rather go and smack them. I also think Mourinho will be doing that, at least in part, because he recognises that Barcelona control the middle of the pitch, so he'll want more players there, he'll want more presence there, perhaps a little bit more aggression in that part of the pitch. But I don't think it would necessarily be defensive, although it will, of course, to some extent, I think, try and play to Real Madrid's great strength, which is the speed of the way they counter-attack, the preciseness of the way they counter-attack. And there was an interesting remark from Ronald de Boer in an interview, I think, with El País this week, and he was saying, I have absolutely no doubt that Barcelona will dominate the game, by which, of course, he means possession. He said, but I actually think that's exactly what Real Madrid want. And there's certainly an element of truth in that.
Sid, hi, it's Amy here. I was just wondering, obviously there's all the attention on the big two, but has it been noticed in Spain that there are actually more Serie A teams still in the Champions League than La Liga teams?
Not yet it hasn't. Well, it's been noticed, of course, but it's not something that's been talked about a lot. I've been quite struck this morning. I think I'm now up to four Spanish radio stations who phoned very excited about the absence of Manchester United and Man City. So that, at the moment, is occupying them more. I think there will come a time where they stop and look at it and go, oh, crap, the Italians have got three teams. But at the moment, that's not on their minds.
Because it is an interesting situation, isn't it? I mean, it's fantastic that Barcelona, their figures, Real Madrid's figures, absolutely extraordinary. But their strength lies in the weakness of the rest of the Liga in many ways. And how much evidence we had of that this week with the performances from Valencia and Villarreal. Has that really not been commented on at all?
It's been talked about a little bit, but not a huge amount, because you have to bear in mind, to say the context, the surprise of, I mean, Villarreal going out was something that had already been assimilated before. The disappointment of Valencia going out, there's a belief that Valencia were pretty unlucky, and I think in some ways they were, not so much in the game against Chelsea, although some people here think they were unlucky in the game against Chelsea, but in the way that the group fell a little bit out of their hands and they ballsed it up a little bit rather than being a poor side. But also, of course, the flip argument to this would be to say, if that is an indication of the fact that the Spanish league isn't strong, well, then what do we take as the indication of what the English league is like right now with Man City, who are winning the league by, leading the league by miles, already out. Now, City could point at the difficulty of the group, so could Villarreal. Villarreal, by the way, a team who are in crisis in Spain as well. You know, they're down in 15th, I think I'm right in saying, and really struggling. But say, because of the context of this, Clásico week, Madrid-Barcelona dominating the agenda as well as the reality on the pitch. Villarreal already out, so everybody had already kind of dealt with that issue in their minds. Valencia feeling a bit unlucky and focused on that game rather than as an overall package. I think if this had happened in a week that wasn't Clásico week, I think maybe tomorrow we'd be seeing an analysis pieces about why this is happening, and certainly that that query about the UEFA coefficient is something that's always quite present in Spanish minds, and in particular if it's Italy that claws it back, because of course Italy are the footballing nation they most like to look at with a kind of combination of fear and loathing.
All right, Philippe is wagging a finger in an excited fashion.
Philippe. Hi, Sid, it's Philippe here, and I'm actually just looking at the UEFA coefficient, you know, and updated after.
We're losing producer Ben, Philippe.
We're losing producer Ben. Why?
Yeah. I think the words UEFA and coefficient might.
No, it's not without interest. I mean, first of all, France is above Portugal again, which is very good news.
All right,
but if I look at this season as well as the previous seasons, I mean. If they are gloating about Manchester teams being out of the Champions League, if they look at the UEFA ranking points, Spain is still behind England
at
the moment.
True.
For this season, not just over the 5 years.
Yeah,
they're well aware of that. But I think the other thing is again to look at this in terms of the context of you know the debate and the narrative that's always put forward by the Spanish media. And right now, the impact of the two Manchester teams out of this season. It's not an impact to do with wow, this means the US coefficient.
No, it's just crazy.
England, but
right?
It will be. It's more looking at it and going, bloody hell, there go two good teams that might have caused Madrid and Barcelona problems. This is Madrid and Barcelona walking to the final now.
Yeah. And Basel against Basel. That's the thing. So anyway, you were saying then, Sid, Barcelona absolutely need to win. In a word, will they?
Oh Christ.
that's a word, but it wasn't the one I was expecting.
I think that...
You've got £5. I will put it on for you on a result. What's the result you want?
If I put £5 on it, I'd be putting the money on Real Madrid. And I'd be putting the money on Real Madrid for a series of reasons.
That's all I wanted. Real Madrid.
You see, this is all people want. They want a prediction. And then they believe that somehow the prediction speaks for everything. Well, the analysis is more important than the prediction.
No,
the result is an imposter in football, Jimbo.
You're right, Sid. But you did do a fair bit of analysis on this before... And I was just curious to know, so at the end of all of that, this could happen, and I read your terrific article on Sports Illustrated as well, but I just want to know who if you thought Real Madrid would actually win this time.
Well, it's leaning that way.
Sid Lowe, very much in Spain. Let's finish off today's Football Weekly Very Extra with a little look at some of the other fixtures that are heading your way in the Premier League this weekend. Mentioned Arsenal-Everton. Haven't mentioned Bolton Aston Villa. Peter Purvis posting in. Hi, says Peter Purvis. I'm from New Zealand. I want to say that other football podcasts are, well, he uses a rude word here. Actually, so is yours sometimes. But I also wanted to ask why no mention of Heskey's ludicrous miss against Man United last weekend. He came on as a sub, took a lame shot at goal, which actually bobbed aimlessly into touch for a throw. I have to say it was an extraordinary shot, in inverted commas, that from Heskey. Rob, Bolton Aston Villa, what's going to happen?
Two very bad teams are going to try and slug at each other and just keep punching fresh air.
These are dangerous times for Bolton, Rob.
Yeah, it's weird. I still think Cole is an excellent manager. Everything points to him being, but they've key players injured and they're in all sorts of trouble.
Yeah.
I still think they are too good to go down, I think.
Oh dear. Now, meantime, Liverpool, who saw their unbeaten run come to an end on Monday night there at Craven Cottage. A little bit of misfortune, if we can use the term there. People asking questions about the red card and that. People asking questions as well about the finger, the Luis Suarez finger. He's now being investigated by the FA, or charged by the FA, is that right?
Yeah.
So potentially what? Would he get a ban for that then, or what? Or
a
fine?
Really got too much ban for... Slightly more extreme swearing. Ronaldo got a one-match ban by UEFA for giving Benfica fans a finger at 05. Ooh. So there are various precedents. I suspect,
I think it's the same as the Rooney situation.
No, it's not. It's not. But Ronaldo's was identical and he got one match from UEFA. I think the FA is scared of Liverpool and I think he'll get away with a fine.
All right, scared of Liverpool. All right. Okay, did you know that Luis Suarez has taken 39 shots in his last 7 matches? How many goals has he scored? Nil point.
Yeah, no player has more touches in the penalty area than Luis Suarez.
Ooh.
In the Premier League.
And
some people say, oh, that shows that he's not such a great player after all because he doesn't convert the chances. Well, maybe if he has more touches, because precisely he's creating danger more than other players. He's a fantastic player. But look, I'm really intrigued to see how Liverpool does without Lucas Leiva.
Yes. Against a newly promoted team, exactly the kind of fixture they usually drop points in at home.
They have, yes, in the past. And he's such an important player for them. Because
So Shelby's...
you will have seen that in terms of scoring goals, Liverpool is down there with... is scored less than Blackburn, I believe. Might be wrong, but I think it's similar or less. Their great strength has been the fact that they've been making sure that whoever was the opposition had no chance at goal. Also, they are the side that has restricted the opposition to the least number of shots at goal.
Same number of goals as Blackburn.
So I wasn't too far.
And they've actually scored less at home than Blackburn have.
Yeah. So it depends a lot on the capacity they have of preventing the attacking midfielders from the other team to approach their box. And Lucas, of course, was absolutely crucial.
Key to that. I think Rob wants to agree with you again.
No,
Rob?
I was just going to say, people gave Benitez plenty of stick for his bad signings, and they said Lucas has won them, but we actually should give Benitez credit because Lucas is clearly a very accomplished midfielder.
Elsewhere in the Premier League, Norwich take on a Newcastle team now suffering because that back four that they built their success on, I'm trotting out the kind of Newcastle cliches, has now been slashed in half by injuries to Colaccini and, of course, Stephen Taylor. Rotten luck, that. Delicate game, that, for Newcastle after a couple of rum results. Although I suppose one at Old Trafford was all right. Swansea taking on Fulham. West Brom taking on Wigan. Sunderland against Blackburn and Stoke Tottenham on the Sunday. Sunderland, Martin O'Neill, his first game in charge. Are we going to see a major, major reboot of the Black Cats?
Well, one thing he's always been very good at is inspiring people very quickly. Ah. So I would expect that there would be a noticeable lift and a noticeable situation where it looks like the players are fighting hard for their manager.
Right.
Stan Collymore said within a few days of working with O'Neill, he'd walk to the ends of the earth for him. I know it's a bit of a cliche, but it shows you how much power he has to motivate people, which I guess is something he kind of learned partially from working with Clough.
Right, if you could get Nicholas Bentner to walk to the end of the earth, that might be a start for them.
In his pink boots, yeah. I think it's as safe an appointment as you can get for a club in trouble.
Right, at home to Blackburn.
No, yeah, I mean O'Neill, but yeah, and okay. Should win at home to Blackburn.
All right, and Stoke, well, Tottenham on that incredible run.
Stoke-Tottenham, I mean, that is a very, very intriguing game. I'm really looking forward to that, I must say. Well, yes, I mean, because Tottenham, they're doing something they haven't done before, which is sometimes they haven't been exactly very good. They have been as flamboyant. I mean, at times they've been magnificent to watch. Probably, in terms of entertainment, the best team to watch in the league at times. But latterly, they haven't always been convincing, but they're actually grinding results, as they say. The score lines are a bit flattering. You see 3-1, you think, okay, but the goal scored in added time. They are very, very strong indeed. But Stoke is on the way back. So even though... there's this great myth that Stoke has got a fortress at the Britannia. Absolutely untrue. It's actually one of the teams that does the least well at home.
They're conceding bundles of goals there as well.
And they have over the past two seasons as well, which is very strange. People think, oh, the Britannia is a terrible place to go. I mean, it's difficult because it's noisy and Stoke are a very difficult team to play against. But in terms of conceding defeats at home, Stoke is actually one of the... actually, in the top 10 teams, it's the one that concedes more defeats at home than any other team in the top 10.
It is now, Rob.
It's absolutely true. The last two seasons.
All right. That, says producer Ben, wielding his big fat production gavel, is it. Except, producer Ben, for, as Rob Smythe points out, the news coming in today from UEFA that Rooney has had his Euro 2012 ban reduced to two games, the important two games, it has to be said, because he'll now be back for the game against Ukraine, although they are a home nation, so it could be difficult. But is this, do you think, going to fire his season back into life in the same way that the ban originally seemed to kill his season?
Probably not. I think his season had gone before the ban. I mean, you never know with Rooney. He always had, every season at Manchester United, he's had a really long period without a goal from open play. This is another...
Eight games now.
It will change at some point. The other thing is that he hasn't been helped. He's been played all over the place. He was playing as a deep-line playmaker for a couple of weeks, which is, of course, absurd. So he's been the one who suffered because of the weaknesses elsewhere.
Okay, did you want to add anything about that, or we've already finished?
Yeah. I want to add something...
about Euro 2012 Rooney?
About Rooney, about the inquiry.
Oh,
yes, because
fresh in.
As we have breaking news, which won't be, by the way, the time this is online. Yeah. This will be fresh, but Jean-Michel Aulas, the chairman of Lyon, has been speaking to French colleagues and has said that according to what he knew, the inquiry hadn't found any irregularities in the betting. That's according to Mr. Aulas, chairman of Lyon.
Okay. Magnificent. Well, There awaits a special Euro paper roundup on Friday, which will no doubt be making all sorts of reference to the big Champions League stories this week. Do join me for that. It's also available on iTunes. We will be back on Monday with a review of the Premier League weekend and all the action around Europe too. So I look forward to speaking to you then. Have a super weekend. In the meantime, many thanks, Amy Lawrence, Philippe Auclair and Rob Smythe for being with us today, and producer Ben. And speak to you after the weekend.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.